Welcome to another episode of the Colorectal Quiz. I'm Thomas XU, and I'll be your narrator today. I'm a pediatric colorectal fellow at Children's National Hospital in Washington, D.C., and today we'll be discussing megarectum and pelvic floor dysfunction. Make sure you download the Stay Current app to follow along with the images and other related cases. Today, we're joined by Dr. Mark Levitt from Children's National Hospital and Dr. Jason Fisher from Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Welcome, guys.
Welcome back, everyone. Let's launch right in. We have a very special guest. This is Aaron Teeple, and Aaron is a pediatric surgeon and an adult colorectal surgeon, and she is the only person in the United States with those two credentials. There's another surgeon from Munich, Germany, Mark Malota, and he also is a pediatric surgeon and a colorectal surgeon. Aaron is our partner here in Washington, D.C. at Children's National. We're very blessed to have her here, and she runs our transition program because, as we all know, our wonderful colorectal patients become adults, and then we need to make sure they get care. Today, we're going to talk about a subject that actually I think pediatric surgeons need to know more about, but adult colorectal surgeons know this like the back of their hand. Aaron's going to impart some knowledge to us on the subject of pelvic floor dysinertia. And to have that discussion, Aaron, I think you've brought us a case.
Yes, thank you for that kind introduction. I do agree it's something that we probably ought to think more about as pediatric surgeons, the pelvic floor and how it functions and how it can sometimes go awry and participate in some of the problems that our kids have. I think it's a little bit under-recognized, and there are some techniques I think we could talk about to try and help these kids in perhaps a different way.
Yeah, I think the pelvic floor seems like a bit of a mystery to many of us. All right, then, let's jump into our first case. The first patient is a 17-year-old who initially presented to urology due to a single episode of urinary retention. He was seen in the ER, and a urinary cath was placed and resolved the issue. However, the urologist he followed up with couldn't figure out why this was happening to an otherwise healthy man.
When something like that happens, we should talk about sexual, urinary, and bowel dysfunction. So he admitted to orchismalgia, and this really persistent and significant testicular pain that was getting worse over time. The testicular pain had an interesting pattern where it was after a hard bowel movement, he would have this significant triggering of this pain, and all he could really do was walk around, and eventually it would pass.
For those who don't know, orchismalgia is pain with ejaculation in males or females.
It is extremely rare to see urinary retention in an otherwise extremely healthy young man. It has to raise a lot of red flags and what I think is going to come of the workup and the differential in this patient.
Yeah, I do think that probably urology sees more of that. That's probably not something that pediatric surgeons get consulted. And if we surveyed pediatric urologists, we might hear about a little bit more. But then the next steps for them, and this is what he came to me with from the urologist, was an MRI spine that was normal and a uroflow that showed a large capacity, but pretty good emptying. They took out the Foley and he used some intermittent capping. They sent him to pelvic floor PT, and ultimately he was able to void spontaneously.
So, Dr. Teeple, given that you specialize in pelvic floor dysfunction, there must be certain historical questions that are important to weed through your differential diagnosis, right?
Pelvic floor dysfunction, being part of my knowledge base, was able to ask these sort of other questions about sexual history, the history around what it was like to have that testicular pain. That's where we talked about testicular pain being elicited by a large hard bowel movement and anal penetrative sex. Those were two things that were significant in my mind for pelvic floor tightness and also constipation, but he had learned to live with that constipation.
Can we just take a brief moment to remind ourselves, we have discussed this on a prior podcast, when you have a patient with bad constipation, I need to implore the people listening to this podcast, think about the sphincters. There are many patients that we have met over the years that have been hammered with lots of laxatives. I know of patients that have had Malone's or cecostomies placed. I know of patients that have had stomas placed, and no one ever evaluated their sphincters. Think about the pelvis. Think about the pelvic floor.
Exactly. And there are many ways to manage it, such as Botox and pelvic floor physical therapy, which can all help improve constipation in these patients.
Mark, I couldn't agree with you more. And Aaron, I want to hear your thoughts. I think take away the patients we typically see with congenital reasons for seeing surgeons. Take those patients out of the picture, anorectal malformations, Hirschsprung's disease particularly. And the patients we see with constipation, I think the majority have a pelvic floor dysfunction. Majority, not half, not 30%. A huge majority have pelvic floor dysfunction. A lot of these patients come when they're potty training or shortly thereafter.
I'd like to make just a little bit of a differentiation because I think that there's pelvic floor dysfunction and then there's distal anismus, which is more external sphincter. So I think we have our withholders, which is who you're talking about, is our potty training toddlers that are constipated. And then I think we have this subset of patients who perhaps have behavioral considerations or delays or nonverbality. And I think they exert a lot of control, and some of that is through their anal sphincters. That's a voluntary muscle.
So it sounds like it's harder to diagnose pelvic floor dysfunction in children than it is in adults. That's probably because all of the testing that's involved, right? There's so many, like the SITS marker study, defectography, and anal manometry. So Dr. Teeple, can you tell us a little bit more about some of them?
We can mimic an anal manometry where we ask them to squeeze and see if there's any dyssynergic contraction of a puborectalis. You know, if you ask them to bear down and you feel that puborectalis squeezing around your finger, that's dyssynergia.
It's probably really hard to do anal manometry, right? Getting a child to hold that balloon in their bottom is probably unsuccessful at certain ages and not a reliable measure of sphincter tone.
The other study that we might do in an adult is a defecography. We don't have a lot of options for defecography. I know in Philadelphia that goes through the adult centers. We certainly didn't have it in a pediatric institution in Philadelphia. And I know here at MedStar, we get defecographies at the adult center. So those things can help sway us, but it's hard to really define the level in which that tightness is happening.
I think taking a history is really important because a lot of these kids, you can't get the data that well from an anorectal manometry or pulmonology. I had a patient that came back that needed Botox for, is mostly withholding behavior, external sphincter tightness. But her problem now is she's very gassy and her colon is always full of air. And when about to give her Botox, as soon as she went off to sleep, she passed gas. And mom gave a history, which I had not heard before. She's very distended all the time, except when she wakes up in the morning. She wakes up in the morning, her abdomen is flat as a pancake because she's been passing gas successfully when she hasn't been thinking about it. So that's clearly a behavioral impact.
Thanks for that tidbit, Dr. Levitt. Okay, let's get back to Dr. Teeple's patient. So now for this patient, you start with a SITS marker study. For those that don't know, this is basically a colonic transit study where tiny radio-opaque markers are ingested and tracked with serial x-rays over a few days. Retained markers may indicate colonic dysmotility or slowness.
In this particular study, it really lends itself to dysfunction of that pelvic floor. See, all those markers are really stacked up against that puborectalis, that pelvic floor. So that is really helpful. This is really an outlet dysfunction.
Can you describe what defecography might look like in a patient with pelvic floor dysfunction?
In a defecography, we retrograde fill the vagina, the anus. We ask patients to take a contrast so that we can see if there's an enterocele, if there's a sigmoidocele. We really want to get a sense of that pelvic floor and anything that might be compressing or leading to an outlet dysfunction. So when the patient defecates, the angle actually tightens at rest. The rectum is actually more straight than during defecation. So instead of relaxing that puborectalis, straightening the rectum and allowing a bowel movement, that puborectalis has tightened and increased the angle. So these are things that you actually calculate quantitatively.
If I want to get these studies, we send the patients across the street to the university and we're able to get them. But because of that, I struggle when I should get them. So when will defecography, whether it be MR or fluoroscopic defecography studies, help us in making diagnoses and treating the patient?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I, too, think a lot about when to get this. Most of them are MR these days, to get these studies, because it is a little bit difficult. It's then out of your institution, out of your hands. Those institutions are not super familiar with kids. They're definitely not going to fill the vagina. Oftentimes, they won't fill the small bowel, which is fine. But when we're looking for pelvic floor dyssynergia, we really don't need those other pieces. So that can be a little bit more user-friendly for the child.
Okay. You can't get the information from anal manometry, a Sitz marker study, and you've already sent them to physical therapy without improvement, and you really believe dyssynergia is the problem. So what now?
If you're really wanting to prove that, what I would do is then Botox the pelvic floor. And if I'm having a hard time getting it covered or I really need to prove it, I'll send them then to Faux.
Great. Now we've taken the history, completed the physical exam, and done our diagnostic testing. What are our treatments?
You are going to start fiber. You're going to optimize their water intake. You're going to start some laxatives, making sure that they've really gotten good, thorough pelvic floor PT, age appropriate, of course. A lot of these adults perhaps have had some trauma background, whether that's sexual abuse or other kinds of abuse. So you really want to screen for that and make sure that psychologically you've gotten them plugged in.
I've heard a lot about Botox. When would you decide to use Botox injections in your treatment?
If you've gotten through all that optimization, diet, fiber, water, laxative, any other kind of psychological and psychiatric intervention, I think the next step is going to be pelvic floor Botox, defo.
Can you just go through your technique of Botox?
I think that's a great question because I think most pediatric surgeons Botox the sphincter.
Just for completion's sake, again, you have successfully made a good distinction between sphincter and pelvic floor. But just for everyone to understand, hearing from your level of expertise, how do you Botox the anal sphincters and how do you Botox the pelvic floor? What is your approach?
So the way I do pelvic floor Botox is take 100 units and dilute it in 10 ml. I take 10 1 ml aliquots and then I need some sort of operative anoscope. If it's a smaller anus, which tends to be in children, you could use a nasal speculum. But I put my finger in, feel the puborectalis. You should be able to feel that puborectalis sling. If you can, it's probably not a tight pelvic floor. And it really ought to feel like a guitar string or a violin string, like you're really feeling a muscle bulk there. I take a spinal needle on each of those 1 ml syringes and pull my finger over that puborectalis, and then right above my finger, I'll inject those 10 1 ml aliquots in the posterior sling of the puborectalis. Because remember, it doesn't come anteriorly. It fixates on that pubic symphysis.
Where exactly are you injecting it?
Into that puborectalis sling that you have to feel. So you feel your landmark and you bring your finger right below it and then you inject right above your finger. You feel that tenseness as you get into the muscle. The same way, let's say for Hirschsprung's, a dentate line injection, you really get the needle into the belly of the muscle. Once you get into that muscle, you can feel it and then you drop it there. But you identify it by bringing your finger right underneath it.
You hook that muscle, whether it be internal sphincter, whether it be puborectalis. You're taking your finger, hooking it. But you can't get all the way around it, but you capture it.
You pull it. What I do is I feel it, that rubber band, and then I come below it. And then obviously you can see the indent of your finger and this bulging of the muscle above it because you've pushed that rectal wall underneath it. And then I come above my finger with my angled spinal needle and sink into the belly of the muscle. and inject there. Oftentimes, it's the right side that's tighter.
Where does sacral nerve stimulator play a role in this and pudendal nerve stimulator?
I haven't seen sacral nerve stimulator used for non-relaxing puborectalis. I really have only seen it used for fecal incontinence and very occasionally for constipation, but it really fails most of the time. That's really a last stitch.
How do you differentiate between levator syndrome and pudendal nerve syndrome?
Or what about other conditions of the puborectalis muscle that might present similarly?
Yeah, I think it's really the terminology that creates more confusion there. Levator syndrome is a little bit tricky because, again, it can present in so many different ways. I think pudendal neuropathy can present as weakness, but also as pain. I think a non-relaxing puborectalis is really what we ought to call levator syndrome. All of it can present as pain. It can present as significant, deep, aching pelvic pain that can be precipitated from that heart bowel movement trying to pass that tight puborectalis. Obstructive defecation, we've talked about. I think that can be... But tricky, right? Because, you don't know the level of that obstruction. You don't know whether it's poor motility or what the problem is there.
Is that a situation where maybe defecography helps with that, figuring that out?
Yes, 100%. Trying to identify the level of that obstructed defecation.
What about solitary rectal ulcer syndrome?
If you don't relax that puborectalis, then when you Valsalva, continually traumatize the posterior walls, there's obliteration of the lamina propria at the level of the puborectalis. That's very classic. So I think the terminology can be a little bit tricky.
Wow, what a great differential diagnosis list you just gave us.
To me, it sounds like you went over some diagnostic criteria. We absolutely learned that history is important, especially in the older patients where you can get more details is extremely helpful. We talked about diagnostic tools and imaging that can be very helpful with this. And then we started to talk about treatments.
I think we need to start thinking about it a little bit more. And also screening our constipation patients for urinary dysfunction and our urinary dysfunction patients for constipation. There's a lot of overlap between bowel and bladder dysfunction. And some of that is in the pelvic floor itself.
And for those interested, there's a pelvic floor consortium held every year in conjunction with the American Society of Colorectal Surgeons, the American Urologic Association, and the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology.
It's really a joint effort amongst all those who are really invested in care of patients with pelvic floor disease. And so I love to participate in that because I think it's a very highly underrepresented source of dysfunction for our patient.
Collaboration is key. We don't know it all as pediatric surgeons, and there are clinicians that are taking care of patients that we see very few of, and we need to learn from them and listen to them. Aaron, thank you for living in both the adult and pediatric world to benefit both and the patients that live in both of those worlds, and I really appreciate you taking the time with us today.
No, this is fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you.